It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll mark the 50th anniversary of the St. Croix National Scenic Riverway in northwestern Wisconsin. First, Amazon announced yesterday that it plans to buy PillPack, a Boston-based company that sorts and delivers prescription drugs and other medical supplies to people's homes. The terms of the deal haven't been disclosed yet, but after the decision, stock in brick-and-mortar pharmacies like Walgreens and CVS took a sharp drop. They did rebound later in the day, but questions remain about what the acquisition means for those chains and for people who rely on prescription medications. Marianne Udall Phillips is the executive director of the Center for Healthcare Research and Transformation at the University of Michigan. Marianne, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Happy to be here.
Well, I think there are a lot of lines of business out there who part of their business plan is hope that Amazon doesn't come into our line. Is this something that could have a big impact on the pharmacy world?
Well, it certainly could have an impact on the pharmacy world. And from a consumer standpoint, of course, consumers would hope that would help lower the cost of prescription drugs, which is a significant problem for many people. You know, I think it's a little bit hard to know about how this is going to play out, because this is really the acquisition by Amazon of a mail-order pharmacy. They've been around for a long time. Other competitors are in the market. So we're just going to have to see how this particular one plays out.
Can you talk about PillPack? It's not a household name, I don't think. Can you talk about how it works and how big a deal it is for people who buy prescriptions?
Right. So it's really a little bit unique in the fact that it has focused on helping people with chronic disease by packaging longer-term prescriptions. So if you need a 30-day supply or more like a 90-day supply of a prescription that's sort of ongoing, it helps package those prescriptions in a way that's helpful for people, easy for them to take, gives them clear instructions, really targeted, I think, to an older market generally. They have worked historically through other distributors, through Express Scripts or CVS Caremark or groups like that in the past. They're not a health insurer themselves, and it's a little bit unclear whether people who have health insurance coverage will be able to buy their drug products through their approach, but their design is to really make their products easy for consumers to use.
I understand they have a license to operate as a pharmacy, in effect, in all 50 states. Is that part of what might make it attractive to a company like Amazon, that they have this existing arrangement?
Exactly. It's very attractive to Amazon, and it really enables Amazon to do what it does really well, right? It's a great distributor of products. It's really efficient in its systems of getting consumer products to consumers, and because that license exists in every state, it makes it very easy for them to be able to distribute prescription drugs in this way.
What is unique about the prescription drug industry that might make it different, maybe more complicated for a company like Amazon than selling, say, a book?
It's a very complicated structure of pricing with many intermediaries in the process that are part of the reason why prescription drug costs are so high. So what Amazon is buying here is sort of one piece in that supply chain, right? But the drug product starts with a manufacturer that has a patent that gets protection on the price of a drug for a certain period of time. That manufacturer sets that price without competition. So, you know, if you look at the book market, there's lots of competition in the book market. It's really quite different from a prescription drug that might be uniquely oriented to take care of a particular problem where there are no substitutes, right? So you have that manufacturer, and they ship the product to a wholesaler, and that wholesaler then has to get this product out to either individual pharmacies or to groups like PillPack. So there's lots of intermediaries in the way. And then, of course, you've got health insurance on the other end that contracts with these different groups to set a rate they'll pay for these drugs.
Talking to Marianne Udall Phillips from the Center for Healthcare Research and Transformation at the University of Michigan, looking at the prescription drug business with Amazon, buying a nationwide distributor, a specialty distributor of prescription drugs, looking at what that might mean for the industry and for people who use prescription medications. Marianne, this comes as some of the retail pharmacies are looking at these interesting mergers, in some cases with insurance companies. What's happening out there pre-Amazon making this this purchase?
Right, that's absolutely right. Well, first of all, the different pharmacy benefit managers have been sort of predicting for quite some time that Amazon was going to get into the prescription drug market. And they've been looking for different strategies to expand their markets and think about markets in a different way. They also know that the price of prescription drugs is under considerable pressure from consumers, that Congress has been looking into these issues, the Trump administration has been making comments about the price of prescription drugs. And so many of them have been thinking that they're going to need to change their business model over time. So you're absolutely right. We see some of the pharmacy benefit managers now talking about merging with health plans and thinking about using those bricks and mortar retail chains also as a way to get health care, get primary care. So there are very interesting things happening in the marketplace right now.
And we've got now with Amazon, you've got their owner, Jeff Bezos, and I think it was Warren Buffett. And they're saying, hey, we're going to start this new health thing. They've got Dr. Atul Gawande, I think, who's been on this show, looking at being in charge of it. It's not clear to me what exactly this new health thing is. How does this play into all of what we're talking about?
Well, you have good questions because none of us really know how this is going to play out. When Amazon and J.P. Morgan and Berkshire Hathaway announced this idea, and it was really just an idea to focus on their own collective employees, you saw, again, stocks drop in the health insurance industry, and you saw stocks take a hit with for-profit hospitals because they're such a big group and they have so much potential impact. But that all happened with nobody knowing exactly what they're going to do. Atul Gawande is a brilliant policy analyst in healthcare. He's also not giving up his other jobs, and so he's going to do this job sort of on the side. He's got lots of ideas about how to improve the quality and the efficiency of healthcare. We're just going to have to see, I think, how they play out in this context.
We've seen Amazon and you know, the internet in general, disrupt is the catchphrase, a lot of industries. Is prescription drugs, getting back to prescription drugs in particular, an industry that is, you think, in need of some kind of creative disruption?
Oh, prescription drug industry is absolutely in the need of a disruption. But it also is, again, very complex, and how prices are set is absolutely not transparent to consumers or policymakers even. So the market needs disruption, but it needs it everywhere from the beginning of how we fund research and development and manufacturing, how we set prices, how transparent those prices are to this whole supply chain. And again, Amazon's just stepping into a piece of that supply chain. They're not yet in that whole continuum.
When I say prescription drug market in the singular, am I oversimplifying? Is there a different market for people with insurance through the workplace, people with federal government health insurance, maybe through their states, people without any kind of insurance?
Yes, well, there certainly is a different market for people who have insurance and those who don't. For those who don't have health insurance for drug coverage at all, they're paying retail prices that are enormously high. Here in Michigan and perhaps in Wisconsin as well, we have people going over to Canada to buy prescription drugs because it's so much cheaper in other countries than it is in the U.S. And so, yes, for that population, it's a very different market than people who have health insurance coverage. Generally, for people who have Medicare with drug coverage, people who have Medicaid, people who have private insurance, it is a market. Each health plan sort of has their own setup and their own drugs that they cover, but they all operate somewhat similarly.
When we're talking about a company like Amazon, I want to bring up a privacy issues here. When you buy a book on Amazon, it recommends the movie of that book or a similar book or something like that. Is it going to be a new challenge for them with a product that there are regulations about privacy like a prescription drug?
Yes, you certainly bring up a good point. As far as we know right now, the way they're going to operate PillPack is as a separate entity, as a separate structure, not integrated with the rest of their structure. So the privacy issues are going to be governed under the way PillPack has been doing it, which very much fits within the law, which fits within HIPAA and other privacy requirements. Over time, I don't know where they're going to head with it. I mean, you could sort of see them integrating with, you know, their decisions to purchase Whole Foods and having sort of a whole healthcare continuum. So we'll have to watch a little bit over time where they go.
Marianne, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, happy to do it.
It's Marianne Udall-Phillips, Executive Director of the Center for Healthcare Research and Transformation at the University of Michigan, with us to talk about Amazon's plans to buy the drug delivery company PillPack. First, it was 1968 when the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act became law. Among the first river systems identified for some type of federal protection was the St. Croix Waterway. The 255-mile waterway is comprised of the St. Croix between Wisconsin and Minnesota and one of its tributaries, the Namekagon, which flows through far northwestern Wisconsin. Wisconsin Senator Gaylord Nelson helped lead the charge to protect the rivers. Here's a clip from the trailer for the new documentary, The Wild and Scenic St. Croix.
It was clear to anybody who was familiar with the river and its location that close to a major metropolitan area that was continually growing, that if something wasn't done to protect the integrity of the shoreline of that river and the use of that river, that pretty soon it would be just another downtown city river like we've got dozens and dozens all over this country.
Now this year, 50 years later, officials are celebrating the efforts to preserve the riverway for generations to come. Our guest is urging people to take part in commemorative events this year, enjoy what the area has to offer, maybe even volunteer to protect the land, air, and water. Deb Ryan is Executive Director of the St. Croix River Association. Deb, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much for having us.
Before we get into the designation as a scenic waterway, what does the scenic riverway mean to you personally?
Oh, it's funny. I just came off the river, as a matter of fact. I was out all morning enjoying this wild and scenic river. So it's a wonderful place to relax. It's a wonderful place to play. And, boy, the scenery is just breathtaking.
Well, give us a little history lesson on what happened 50 years ago with the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act. What was the goal?
Well, actually, there were several goals. The six major themes were preservation, public access, cooperation. Interestingly, it also became a national model. It took dogged determination to make it happen, and individuals were the heroes of the stories. So there are a lot of things that emerged as we look back at the history. It wasn't just one great thing that happened. There was this series of wonderful things that the public benefited from.
Why was the St. Croix seen as a riverway, not just was something that people appreciated, but that needed special protection and needed it right away?
It's really a vital wilderness with abundant habitat, fresh water, and spectacular beauty, but it's so close to a major metropolitan area that it was really in danger of changing. The character of that riverway could be very, very different today if we had not had the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act.
Well, you were out on the water today. You mentioned, paint us a picture. What kind of things do you see in late June?
Oh, in late June, I saw abundant flowers blooming. We're just coming off of high water, so we have a lot of really interesting changes in the river flow. The dynamics of the river changes. In the shallow spots, you can see one of 40 varieties of mussels lining the shoreway, and you can see otters laying on their back, cracking open those mussels and eating them. It's really amazing.
Let's break it down a little bit. The 100-mile-long Namekagon River, Naomi on Facebook writes, the Namekagon has been my home for 60 years. Glad it's protected. It's one of the cleanest rivers in the U.S. Talk about how clean these rivers are thanks to this protected status.
Well, we've got about a quarter-mile buffer along the shores of both the Namekagon and the St. Croix Rivers. And that buffer has provided just a wonderful a barrier between what could be a lot of pollution runoff like you'd see in some other urban or rural areas. A lot of farm runoff simply doesn't hit the river because we've got that beautiful buffer. But more importantly, it really acts as a sponge. So when we have that high water, the river is able to bounce back. It's very, very resilient. It also provides unbelievable habitat. So we have endangered mussels. We discovered the St. Croix snake-tailed dragonfly here. It was first discovered in the 1980s on this river. There's just so many different species of plants and animals that are either unique to their area or very rare and find the riverway home.
Talk about that buffer a little more. How was that land acquired or set aside to help protect the river?
There's a series of ways the river is protected. First of all, there is some that the National Park simply owns outright. There is also a series of state and regional parks, so Wild River State Park, is also right along this riverway. But then there are also a whole lot of individual landowners that have scenic easements on them. So there are some restrictions on what that they can do on their own property in order to protect this river. So they can't, for instance, cut down trees. They need to keep a natural shoreline. All of those things really do help protect the quality of the water and the resources besides the water.
Talking to Deb Ryan, Executive Director of the St. Croix River Association, talking about the St. Croix National Scenic Riverway set aside, protected 50 years ago. Deb, you mentioned that public access was one of the key goals of this designation. Can you talk about what public access is like to the river now?
Oh, it's wonderful. You can go, and we'll go back to the Namekagon. About every, 3 to 4 miles, you'll find that you can enter this national park, and it's a free national park to anyone. So whether you're a kayaker, a canoer, an angler, even a hunter, it's open to the public year-round, 24/7, and there are just so many different entry points that are available for people to use. It's very easily accessed. The other thing I really like about this river is it's open to so many different types of recreation. So the Namekagon and the Upper St. Croix are narrow and windy and shallow and really great for canoeing and kayaking with some Class 1 and 2 rapids. As you move down the river, then you'll see some john boats and some pontoon boats. And then as you get further down yet, you'll see some really large yachts that may go all the way to the ocean. So it's really an every man's or every person's river that you can enjoy in so many different ways.
What kind of things are you doing through the summer to mark the 50th anniversary?
Well, we had a premiere for the Wild and Scenic St. Croix movie. We'll be doing more of those. It's showing on Twin Cities Public Television right now, but we'll be debuting on Wisconsin Public Television soon as well. But during the summer season, when the water's open and it's so glorious, we do several day paddles or evening paddles or week-long paddles along the river. We do some hikes. We do some bike rides. All of those things you can find on our website.
And is there work that people can volunteer to do to help out the waterway?
One of the most important things that we're doing during this year-long celebration is helping people to find ways to be good stewards for this river. One of the really important ways that this river was protected was because there was so much collaboration. So there was the Park Service, the government that came in and helped. There was Northern States Power who gave so much land in order to create this park. But it took all those citizens who cared, who really make the difference. So we're always looking for people to either, as they're out there, take care of the river themselves, or they can contact us, and we have a number of different ways where they can get involved.
And I understand you are encouraging especially younger generations to find their way onto the river.
We sure are. We're getting nervous that this next generation is not really getting out and playing the way some of us older folks did when we were kids. And so a lot of our activities are really focused on bringing out new audiences. And that might mean more diverse audiences as well. This riverway tends to be used by people who are my age and maybe a little older, maybe a little younger, but it's really important that the next generation and folks of all shapes, sizes, and colors get out and use it.
We also heard from John on Facebook who wrote, fond memories of canoeing with fraternity brothers in the 70s. Do you maybe informally or formally collect stories from people who have enjoyed the river over the years?
We sure do. We have a Facebook page, too, and we collect them and we use them throughout our work. So we love hearing all those stories. And really, there are so many fantastic multi-generational stories. So like your fraternity brothers, that's one really good story. But a lot of people have come here with their great-grandparents, grandparents, parents, children, and now their grandchildren. So it can be multi-generational stories that we continue to hear.
Are there any challenges you see facing the waterway that you're worried about or working on?
Boy, we sure do see challenges. The three major program areas that we work in are invasive species, land and water protection, and then we do a lot of education and outreach. And the invasive species, boy, they just seem to be multiplying. So it's one of those things that we work really hard to minimize the impact that they have. A more diverse ecosystem will stay healthy longer, and it's really, really important for us. And then on the water quality side, we see, obviously, egg runoff is one of the concerns that we still have. Poor water quality coming in through some of the tributaries. So we work on runoff issues out in the upland and throughout the watershed. And then land protection. As the Twin Cities and other towns start moving out, maintaining that wild and scenic character that you now have is really critical and really, really tough, because everybody wants their piece of paradise. And if we have house after house, we don't have paradise anymore.
As we wrap up, are you going to get back out on the water this weekend?
You betcha I am. I plan to be out all weekend long, and I sure hope everybody does too.
Deb, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You bet. Thank you for having me.
Deb Ryan is the executive director of the St. Croix River Association. We talked to her about the 50th anniversary of the St. Croix National Scenic Riverway in northwestern Wisconsin. You can learn more about the Riverway's history and things to do there on the National Park Service website. We've got a link on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can also check out the new half-hour-long documentary, The Wild and Scenic St. Croix, at the Wisconsin Public Television website. Go to videos.wpt.org and search for the title. It's Food Friday, and as you know, we usually talk about making delicious and healthy food. In order to make the delicious food, though, you have to have the right gear. Paul Bunyan had his axe, Betsy Ross had her needles and thread, Julia Child had her kitchen walls covered in pegboard to hang her large arsenal of cooking utensils. You can join the conversation. What is your most essential kitchen tool? Or is there a kitchen gadget that you bought and regretted and it's gathering dust somewhere? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Dr. Stuart Fairmond joins us now. He's a food scientist and the author of The Science of Cooking, Every Question Answered to Perfect Your Cooking. He's here to give us the scoop on what cooking tools are essential to have in the kitchen. Dr. Stu, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob. Great to chat again.
Well, let's get into this. We've talked to you about cooking with meat, some baking in the past. Now we're going to work on the hardware. And I'll say, I don't need to buy pots and pans right now, but when I have bought them in the past, I'm overwhelmed with the different options and selections out there. Can you start to sort out the world of pots and pans for us?
There are a lot on there. It's like any kind of going to a supermarket or something. There's so many different varieties. What on earth do you go for? What kind of pans have you got at home?
Oh, I've got a mishmash. I've got some cast iron skillets, which I like for many things. I've got, you know, some kind of nonstick. I think we have one of those cephalon, whatever they're called. See, I don't even know. I've got the stuff I've been cooking with for years.
Yeah, and you often get stuff given to you as wedding presents and all that stuff. I would keep it nice and simple. I think cast iron is great. It's really trendy. And that's a fantastic metal for retaining heat. I don't know what you use it for, but when you're cooking with it, you probably notice that when it's up to temperature, which can take an age, it holds onto the heat really well. So you can take it off the heat and it'll still carry on cooking the steak or whatever it is that's on there. And all your other pans, they come in different flavors and varieties, different variations on, most of the time, it's stainless steel. And stainless steel is a fairly cheap metal, but the problem is that it conducts heat quite poorly, but it's really easy to clean. So what you will find that's very popular now is called tri-ply, triple layered, essentially, pans that have the stainless steel on the top and the bottom, so it's kind of easy to clean. In the middle, you've got a really well-conducting metal, like aluminium or copper in the middle. They're quite expensive, but that gives you the best of both worlds. So you've got the easy cleaning, non-corrosible surface, but then you've got the advantage of these metals like copper, which copper's incredibly expensive, I think you could probably buy a set for about $1,000 or, you know, even more than that. There's a lot of snobbery around kind of the pans and the metals that you use. But tri-ply, that's a really good compromise rather than just sort of spending a fortune on copper pans, which are very good, but they're really heavy. So they're not going to be good for kind of sorting and tossing a meat around in a pan. So get the advantage of the copper by going for one of those layered pans.
Is that the tri-ply going to help distribute the heat better? Because I know sometimes if I'm making, say, pancakes, the pancake on the upper left corner is done. The other one is raw in the lower right. I have to, you know, I turn the pan around. I can predict it now. But will better pans distribute the heat more evenly?
Yeah, hotspots, they're a bit of a pain, aren't they? Yes. And actually, more important than the metal is the thickness. Now, the people that sell you expensive pans don't tell you this. They just tell you it's a copper pan. And we all know copper transfers heat really well and will spread the heat out nicely. But aluminium, for example, that's a really cheap metal and it lets heat go through it really quickly. And if you've got a thin aluminium pan, you will get these hot spots forming. But if you've got thick aluminium, it's just as good as thin copper. So it's the thickness of the metal that is really important for spreading that heat out, because you're giving the maximum distance between your burner and the food, which is resting inside. So the thicker, the better. So when you're shopping around for pans, look for the thickness of the base rather than the one that's all singing, all dancing, and has got this expensive metal.
Once in a great while, Dr. Stu, I'll run across a recipe that says use a non-reactive pan. I don't remember what kind of recipe is that for. What's that about? Are there some materials that will ruin a recipe?
I think probably what they're saying is they're probably saying stainless steel, because that will withstand most things. Occasionally you can get pitting from lots of salt in the base without any kind of oil or any of the liquid in the bottom. But essentially stainless steel is very non-reactive, whereas aluminium, if you use acidic ingredients in aluminium, then it will stain, and also some of the aluminium comes off, and so it gives it a kind of a metallic tang. Although you can get anodized aluminium, which has been treated so that is essentially resistant like stainless steel. So anodized aluminium, stainless steel, copper. Most copper nowadays has a coating on the inside so that the copper doesn't come off. So providing you've got a glazed copper pan, an anodized aluminium pan, or a stainless steel pan, they are your non-reactive pans.
Talking to Dr. Stuart Faramond, author of The Science of Cooking, Every Question Answered to Perfect Your Cooking. We're talking about the gear, the gadgets in the kitchen. Dr. Stu, let's turn to knives. Those get a lot of attention, I think. There are different options out there for the, you know, casual home cook. What's a good, reliable knife for them and for me?
First of all, don't bother with the sets. They make for nice gifts, but if you've got a set of knives, there's probably about two of them that you use, and the rest of them just sit there and look pretty. Have you got a set of knives?
I do. Speaking of wedding gifts, so these knives are pretty old at this point and probably in need of sharpening. But yeah, and you're right. I use the big one. I use the little ones. Bread knife when I need a bread knife, and there's a couple that are like, if everything else is dirty, I pull it out.
Yeah, it's so true. Yeah, and that's all I recommend is you get a big one, you get a chef's knife, and knives are right to put some time and some money into, because if you're doing cooking, you're doing a lot of chopping. It's probably perhaps the main thing that you're doing in a kitchen when you're not in front of the burner is doing the chopping. So a chef's knife is crucial. And that's the kind of your fairly large size knife. It's got normally got a cut. And so you can do that kind of that rocking motion with your herbs and stuff. That's your kind of your mainstay. And you can use the broad side for kind of cracking garlic cloves and things like that on it. So your chef's knife, that's the one that you want. You want a small knife for kind of getting in the nooks and the crannies, a paring knife. They're often called the real small ones. And I would say a serrated knife as well for cutting your bread. Serrated knives last a really long time. Compared to your other kinds of knives. So they would be the ones I would recommend. You could also get a long slicing knife, which is good for doing nice thin slices of meat. They're the ones that you want to go for. And when you're looking for knives, I think it's a false economy if you say, I'm just going for a cheap one because it doesn't matter too much. Because you kind of get what you pay for. I think, with knives, and because you're using it so much, so things to look out for when you're getting a knife, ideally go for a knife that is forged. And, you know, we've all seen those images of the blacksmiths and the anvil, and they're banging away the metal to sort of forge a knife or something, or a blade. Well, forged knives that you get today are kind of, they're made in a similar way. So the metal has been heated and cooled and banged to make the metal really, really hard and hard wearing. Whereas a lot of cheaper knives, they're called stamped knives, which just means that the metal has come off a sheet and it's been sort of stamped out with a stencil that looks the shape of a knife, and then one side's been sharpened, and then they stick a handle on it, and there's your knife. They're not as good. They don't keep their edge as well, and they're more likely to fall apart, basically. So for looking for a forged knife, when you're looking at it, you'll see that the very tip, if you're looking down on the knife, the very tip is narrower than at the handle end. And you'll see at the handle end, it flays out towards the handle. And that shows you that it's come from, that all that curvature has come from one piece of metal rather than just a sheet that's been sandwiched between two halves of a handle. So always look for a forged knife. And there's a lot of snobbery around. Do you go for a carbon steel knife, or do you go for a stainless steel knife? In the days of yore, stainless steel was terrible, and it would lose its sharpness really quickly, and chefs would only go for carbon steel. The difference between carbon steel and stainless steel: stainless steel is essentially steel, but it's got an added element in called chromium that stops it reacting. But those extra bits of chromium in there can make it softer, not make it as good a cutting edge. But modern stainless steel is a lot better, and is pretty much, if you get decent stainless steel, comparable with carbon steel. So I would say look at some online reviews of knives. If you're an everyday kind of cook like me, go for a stainless steel knife, and look for one that's forged rather than stamped. And that's the best advice for most knives. You can go for ceramic; they're super, super sharp, but frighteningly difficult to sharpen. If you drop it on the floor, they'll break.
Talking to Dr. Stuart Faramond, food scientist and author of The Science of Cooking, Every Question Answered to Perfect Your Cooking. We're getting his advice on the tools of the trade, what we need in our kitchen, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What tools do you think every kitchen should have? Is there a particular favorite knife or other kitchen gadget, piece of gear that you use all the time? It's your go-to, whether it's new and fancy or something that's been handed down through the generations. Or did you plunk down for a kitchen gadget that you used once 10 years ago? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about essential tools for the kitchen with Dr. Stuart Faramond. He's a food scientist and author of The Science of Cooking. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite kitchen tool, or your least favorite? 800-642-1234, or post in the Ideas Network Facebook page. Want to turn now for a moment, before we go to our callers, to the wonderful world of spatulas.
There's just one place to go for all your spatula needs.
Spatula City!
Spatula City! A giant warehouse of spatulas for every occasion. Thousands to choose from in every shape, size, and color. And because we eliminate the middleman, we can sell all our spatulas factory direct to you. Where do you go when you want to buy name brand spatulas at a fraction of retail cost? Spatula City! 7 locations. We're in the yellow pages under Spatulas.
From Weird Al's UHF, Dr. Stu, give us some spatula pointers. Dr. Stu, are you there? All right, looks like we lost our connection with our guest. Fun to hear about Spatula City. Let's go to your calls now. Want to hear your favorite bit of kitchen gear. We'll go to Aaron with us in Kenosha. Aaron, hi.
Hi.
Hi, Aaron. What is your favorite kitchen gadget?
So my favorite kitchen gadget, it sounds a little obscure, but I picked up a $4.99 pineapple core and slicer. And if you've ever cut a pineapple before, it's
it's a pain.
Annoying. It's such a pain. And the pineapple core and slicer, you literally just cut the top of the pineapple off, and you just screw the thing down. super easy. You can have an entire pineapple sliced and cored in about 30 seconds.
And to be worth that $5, Erin, you probably eat a fair amount of pineapple, I'm guessing.
Yeah, you know, and it's just, it's one of those things that, you know, it's just, it's definitely worth it to purchase, so.
Thanks so much for sharing that, Erin. Dr. Stu, I heard a telltale noise. Are you back?
I'm here.
I'm sorry. We lost you there. Is there, Dr. Stu, a gadget that you, as a cook yourself, as well as food scientist, bought and regretted?
Well, first say the bread maker. It was fun for 2 or 3 months, and then it became a bit of a chore. My wife and I have now gone back to making bread the old-fashioned way, and it's much more fun. So the bread maker, yes, but a pasta maker doesn't get much use. But most things tend to get given away if they don't get used. And I probably don't have enough pineapple to pour enough pineapple.
Yeah, mine was, so I used to do a lot of canning of tomatoes, and I got a tomato shark, which is like a melon baller with serrated edges, like teeth, and it's great for popping that top out of the tomato. It was cheap, but now I don't can anymore, and yeah, my tomato shark needs are few and far between. Let's go back to our callers. We've got Mark with us in Bowler. Mark, hi.
Yes. I was in Alaska last year, and I bought a knife called Ulu, U-L-U. It's an Eskimo design knife, and I find it so functional and easy to use, and they're extremely sharp. Holds an edge, and it's my go-to knife almost for everything now.
Great. Thanks a lot for that call, Mark. And Dr. Stu, I think chefs do feel that attachment with their knives. When they find a good one, they're going to stick with it.
Yeah, absolutely. I've just had a look at Ulu knives because I've not seen them before. They're like a rocking knife. They're doing your small leaves and your herbs and all those sorts of things. Yeah, they look good. If you do all that stuff, then yeah, go for it.
We also heard on Facebook from Deborah. She says her must-have tool is her incredibly sharp 8-inch chef's knife. Mary Ann needs her Warthog brand knife sharpener. Talk about sharpening a little. That's something I don't do enough, Dr. Stu.
Yes, or do you? I mean, have you got one of those honing steels, or sometimes called sharpening rods?
Yeah, it was part of the kit. My wife used it once, but didn't tell me, so I did nick myself, not expecting my knife to be so sharp.
Yeah, they don't actually sharpen.
They don't.
What they do is they hone a knife. So if you can imagine the sharp cutting edge of the knife, if you were to zoom in really, really, really close, it would be like going to a smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller to a tiny little point. And that's your cutting edge. And obviously the smaller that is, the sharper it will be, the more pressure it's going to be putting on the food when you slice it. Now, over time, that really narrow, sharp edge bends over. And it loses its sharpness because you would have thought that metal will bend, but it does because it's so small, it bends over. And at that point, it feels blunt when you're trying to cut with it and you're having, you know what it's like when you've got the tomato and your knife doesn't work with the tomato anymore and you've got to get your bread knife out to slice it to get the nice thin slices. And to sort that out, you need to get your honing steel or what's sometimes called sharpening rod. And you need to scrape it down the side. Oh. Essentially, there's videos on YouTube. You can see how to do it. And the professional chefs, they look the dom when they do it. And that essentially brings that back into line. So it gets rid of that curvature that's happened on the end of the blade. So it lines it back up again. And so it feels like a sharp knife again. It doesn't actually sharpen it because to sharpen it, you've got to wear away the metal and to make a whole new. So a steel doesn't do that. It just sort of aligns it again to make cutting easier. You can do that so many times. And generally, if you speak to a butcher or somebody who uses knives all the time, they will say that they do that in between each, pretty much in between every job or every other job they do. They'll hone it. And then every once in a while, they'll sharpen it, which means putting it through a machine or ideally use a whetstone because the machines aren't brilliant and they take away quite a lot of metal. And then that forms a whole fresh new edge and you get a new fresh point again.
Let's go back.
So you could hone for a bit, but you won't cure a truly blunted knife.
Let's go back to our callers. Desmond is with us in Wyawega. Desmond, hi.
Hey, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
All right. Well, first of all, I really appreciate my local NPR station, and I listen every single day.
Thanks.
Just because there's always something new and something I find interesting. Anyhow, the topic of the day, different kitchen utensils and whatnot and devices. I have a knife that my parents had won while they were still together, and going through the divorce, it was something that neither one of them wanted to let go of. Anyhow, my mother ended up finding one, and I couldn't believe she found one because I thought it was an older knife. It is a brand called Geneva Crucible, and it's Geneva Crucible Forge, made in USA, and I mean vegetables, meat, bread. This knife is such a great knife. I don't know if you're familiar with the Geneva Crucible.
I'm not. Desmond, thanks
for
that.
No, I'm not.
But it's a forge. I assume it's one of those forged knives you were talking about, Dr. Stu, and apparently good enough to be a contentious item in a divorce proceeding.
Fantastic. Yeah, I'm just looking at some of the images of it. Yeah, it looks like a good old traditional. Is it a chef's knife that you're using?
Well, it is. I want to say it's semi-serrated. It's serrated, and it's got a couple of notches throughout the band of the knife. And I looked them up online, and you can get them for about $25, $30. But it is such a good knife.
All right. Thanks, Desmond, for the call. I want to get into one more item, cutting boards. I've got a couple wood ones that we've had forever, a ceramic one. I know there are plastic ones out there. What do you go to?
Wooden every time. Yep. There was a big thing a few years back where wooden was out because it was unhygienic, and kitchens everywhere used plastic. But the science that was based on was wasn't really watertight, and we now know that wood is actually quite good and in many ways superior to plastic. I'd steer clear of the marble ones and the stone ones and the really hard ones because they blunt your knife, and they're also really cold. The metal ones, they'll transfer the heat away from whatever it is you're cooking, pot, your chop, you're putting on your board, which isn't great if you're doing lots of baking. But wood is good. It's actually got substances in it that are antibacterial, so they will help fight off germs. Whereas plastic, they're easy to wash, and you can get different colours, which is great when you're working in a professional kitchen, because you can have one colour for raw meats, one for vegetables, and all the rest of it, and you can keep track of your boards very nicely. But when you've started to cut into plastic, and you know that your plastic boards, they pick up those scratches all along them when you've had them for more than 6 months, and in those little scratches, bugs can build up in there, and they form what's called a biofilm, and they kind of nestle in there, and so they need really careful heating on a really high temperature to make sure that your chopping board stays really hygienic. Whereas with wood, it doesn't seem to be such a problem because it's from a plant. It's got these got natural substances in it to fight off those bugs. So wood, good trustworthy wood is good. The cheaper wood.
I'm going to jump in. We're just about out of time. Thanks to Dr. Stuart Faramond, author of The Science of Cooking, Every Question Answered to Perfect Your Cooking. We've been talking about his must-have tools for a well-functioning kitchen. You can still share your favorite kitchen piece of gear over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. Yesterday, we asked you to tell us about your collections, what you collect and why, and turns out you collect a lot of stuff. We didn't get all of your comments on the air yesterday. Here are a few more of your collections. On Facebook, Kim writes, prosthetic eyes, parentheses, human, and parentheses. Many I have are from the World Wars era, made in Germany. They're little works of art. Could be creepy to the visitors. Vanessa says, I collect political campaign buttons and pins. That's, I think, a little more common one. We also have a couple more from our hotline that we didn't get to yesterday. Here is one of them.
Hi, I collect The Wizard of Oz, and I think I'm just a child at heart. Thank you.
She didn't specify what of The Wizard of Oz she collects. Maybe the wizard himself. I don't know. Don't look behind the curtain, though, either way. Here's another one of our callers.
Mark, I'm from Oregon, Wisconsin. And one of the things I like to collect are rocks. They're super cheap, And my collection is pretty small. It fits in a small wooden box. And sometimes it's just a cool piece of quartz. Crystals are sticking out. Or fossils. There are a ton of fossils just right there for the picking. And it's very cool.
And we asked around here, Connemara in our business sponsorship office collects all vintage things Western-themed, cowgirl bedspreads, Pendleton blankets, lassos, and more. She has an entire room dedicated to it. And Susanna collected postcards as a teen, still has around 100 or 200 of them. You can still share your collections on the Ideas Network Facebook page. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.